Hello, it's Wednesday the 5th of January and welcome to another edition of Korea 24. I'm your host, Kwon Jang-woo. North Korea has fired a projectile believed to be a ballistic missile into the East Sea in the regime's first provocation of the new year. We'll have more details in our news briefing shortly. Today marks 30 years of the Wednesday rallies that call on the Japanese government to apologize for the sexual enslavement of women during wartime. We look back at the significance of the protests for our in-depth today. And then coming up on Korea Book Club, we'll be looking at a poetry collection by Andrew Tol that explores the dark and melancholic side of life. Let's begin Korea 24. In its first show of force of the new year, North Korea has fired a projectile believed to be a ballistic missile into the East Sea of the Korean Peninsula. The South Korean and U.S. militaries are analysing data while diplomats mull a proper response. For more on this and our other headlines of the day, we're joined in the studio by KBS World Radio news editor Eunice Kim. Hello, Eunice.
Hello, Jang-ho.
So let's start with the facts of the situation then. When did this projectile launch occur?
According to South Korea's Joint Chiefs of Staff, the projectile, which it presumes to be a ballistic missile, was shot from an inland region of Chagang Province into the East Sea at around 8:10 a.m. today. It added that South Korean and U.S. military authorities are closely analyzing related data and that both sides are maintaining defense readiness. Japanese media also reported the launch, saying the Japan Coast Guard announced at 8:13 a.m. that what is likely a ballistic missile was launched from the north. The latest test launch does come 78 days after the state had tested its newest submarine-launched ballistic missile. An emergency meeting of the National Security Council's Standing Committee was convened to discuss its response to the incident. In a press release, the presidential office said the committee members expressed concern that the launch came at a time when stability at home and abroad is indispensable. They also reaffirmed the need to resume dialogue with the North. Now note the word concern, which is scaled down from comments following previous provocations in which the NSC had issued quote-unquote deep concerns. The committee also did not characterize this test fire as a provocation.
And a similar tone was struck by President Moon Jae-in as well, who decided to attend a groundbreaking for a new rail line that will be connected to North Korea. So what did he have to say?
Right. He attended the ceremony about 3 hours after North Korea had test fired that suspected ballistic missile. President Moon, in referring to the launch in his address, said that dialogue must continue to overcome such situations. He reaffirmed his will to achieve peace and prosperity on the Korean Peninsula, saying peace won't come automatically, but will happen suddenly when the two Koreas jointly make an effort and build trust. More on that coastal railway, the completion of the railroad between the eastern city of Gangneung and Jejin Station in Gosong County, which is also in Gangwon Province, is expected to link to North Korea and ultimately be a part of a joint railway network that reaches all the way to Eurasia. Under a 2002 inter-Korean deal, Jejin Station was linked to North Korea's Gamho Station back in the year 2007.
The president was more stern, however, over revelations that the military had again failed to detect, thus stop a North Korean defector from crossing the fortified border over the weekend.
Right, this despite mounted surveillance cameras catching the man on 5 separate occasions, as it was revealed today. According to presidential spokesperson Park Young-mi, President Moon Jae-in said the botched patrol operations at the 22nd Division is one that simply cannot happen, stressing the gravity of the issue. He said the military must have an extra sense of vigilance and take responsibility for its repeated failures to detect border crossings. crossings. He instructed the military to take corrective action to ensure such a breach does not happen again, his spokesperson said, ordering an on-site inspection as well as a military-wide inspection on security posture. The Joint Chiefs of Staff on Wednesday had revealed that the North Korean man, he was caught 5 times on 3 surveillance cameras at the South's General Outpost just outside the DMZ Saturday evening. That triggered warning lights and alarms, but 6 troops who were dispatched to that location had failed to find anything unusual. The military again failed to detect the breach while checking recorded footage, due in part to discrepancies between the actual time and when the recordings were stored in the server. The chief of the command control at the battalion in charge also neglected to report the incident to higher-ups, which goes against the manual, and it wasn't until 9:17 p.m. that the military realized there was something unusual after spotting the man in the DMZ through a thermal observation device.
Okay, let's continue on and turn to the tumult in the world of Korean politics. Next, a big decision was announced from the main opposition People Power Party's presidential candidate, Yoon Sung-yeol. He pledged a quote-unquote definitive new start, dismantling his quote-unquote mammoth election committee, as well as edging out the so-called kingmaker, Kim Jong-un. So where does this leave the campaign then?
That's a great question. Perhaps we'll get more of an answer in the coming days, as we are now 2 months away to the presidential election day. Many people had advised Yoon to still keep Kim Jong-un by his side, but after reportedly feeling blindsided by Kim's announcement at the start of this week that the election committee must be overhauled amid persistent internal discord, Yoon Sung-yeol has decided to do it his way. In a press conference breaking his silence over the past 2 days, on Wednesday, Yoon announced he would dissolve his election committee and replace the mammoth committee of lawmakers with a streamlined election headquarters consisting of young and talented hands-on staff. It will be led by 4-term lawmaker Kwon Young-se, with other appointments to come on Thursday. Yoon did thank his former committee general chairman Kim Jong-un, who resigned prior to the announcement, adding that he had asked Kim for continued advice during their phone call that morning. Yoon also took full responsibility for failing to win public trust in his leadership of the party and the election committee. He also promised to hold the same principles and standards he's consistently held since his days as prosecutor to his family members as well.
Over at the ruling Democratic Party, a marked difference in mood. Its presidential candidate, Lee Jae-myung, on the campaign trail in the southwestern city of Gwangju, was joined by his former primary rival, Lee Nak-yeon.
Yes, the two Lees showed a united front as they jointly presided over the inaugural meeting of a National Unity Vision Committee as co-chairs in the former Democratic Party leader's support base and the DP's traditional stronghold, the Jeolla region. Lee Jae-myung emphasized that the Democratic Party has the DNA for unity and solidarity as he pledged to follow public command and mobilize all resources to overcome the COVID-19 pandemic. Lee Nak-yeon, who had also served as prime minister under the Moon government, promised to continue advancing the party, saying democracy earned through Gwangju's bloodshed must not regress. The DP is also accelerating talks on the government's first extra budget proposal for the new year, ramping up pressure on the government as well as the opposition parties to cooperate to aim to reach a deal in time for the Lunar New Year holiday, which Jiangho starts at the end of this month, January 31st this year.
Let's look to COVID-related headlines now. Quite a bit of noise has been made recently, challenging the government's COVID-19 pass system, now being expanded to more facilities. And the government now says it will try to minimize inconveniences faced by the public due to the entry system.
Yeah, Interior and Safety Minister Chun Hae-chol, who is also the deputy director of the Central Disaster and Safety Countermeasures Headquarters, relayed that pledge during a meeting on Wednesday. He explained that the government limited the facilities implementing the pass system to protect the unvaccinated, contain the spread of the virus, and ease the strain on the medical system. that it will work harder to minimize public discomfort. This comes as yesterday the Seoul Administrative Court had accepted a request for an injunction to temporarily suspend the system's adoption at private educational facilities such as cram schools and study cafes. This request was filed last month by civic groups who argued that the measure breached students' rights to study as well as the rights of the owners of those businesses. Meanwhile, the Justice Ministry today instructed the Health Ministry to immediately appeal the court decision, underlining the importance of the system in the overall quarantine strategy. The move comes as the court ruling is likely to have ramifications on other facilities subject to the COVID-19 pass system. We're already hearing of rumblings within the restaurant industry.
And where are we in terms of our daily infection numbers?
We had fewer than 4,500 new COVID-19 cases reported on this hump day amid gradual signs of a let-up, while critical cases stayed below 1,000 for the second straight day. The KDCA said there were 4,444 cases compiled throughout Tuesday. That is about 960 cases less than the same time last week. 211 of them were overseas transmissions. There were 953 critical patients, which is 20 fewer than Tuesday, and marks the lowest that we've seen in 3 weeks. 57 more people have died of the virus, however.
And finally, we're now 1 month away from the Beijing Winter Olympics, and the national team pledged to put up a good fight at the Games that will run from February 4th through to the 20th.
Yeah, can you believe it? 1 month away. At a press conference, the Korean Sport and Olympic Committee said the national team hopes to win at least 2 gold medals in traditional strong events, such as short track speed skating, and rank 15th or higher overall. Some 5,000 athletes from some 90 countries are set to compete for 109 gold medals in 15 disciplines at the Beijing Winter Games.
We wrap it up there for our news briefing. Thank you for those updates.
You bet.
Today marks the 30th year of a weekly civic rally here in Seoul that urges Japan to formally apologize and compensate victims of the Japanese military sexual slavery program during World War II, euphemistically known as Comfort Women. The rallies have been a powerful symbol in the ongoing struggle to find justice for the victims, but with Seoul-Tokyo relations more frosty than ever, there seems little hope that such an apology or resolution will be reached in the near future, which is particularly concerning as only 14 registered victims still remain today. To reflect on the significance of the rallies and the prospects of Seoul-Tokyo relations, we're joined on the line now by Oh Jun, South Korea's former ambassador to the United Nations, who now serves as chair of Save the Children Korea. Ambassador Oh, thank you for speaking to us today.
Thank you for having me.
Now, on this week in 1992, the Korean Council for Justice and Remembrance for the Issues of Military Sexual Slavery by Japan organized the first Wednesday rally on the occasion of then-Japanese Prime Minister Kiichi Miyazawa's visit to Seoul. It was held in front of the Japanese embassy at the time, and they've carried on every Wednesday for 30 years, bar a handful of exceptions. Ambassador, as we witness this anniversary today, what's been going through your mind?
Well, I think the years 1991 and 1992 were critically important in bringing the so-called comfort woman issue to the attention of Korean society and of the whole world. I use the term comfort women because that is exactly the euphemism the Japanese military used to call its military sexual slavery that time. In 1991, the late Miss Kim Hak-soon became the first living proof of comfort woman as she came out with her own experience as a comfort woman victim. She was followed by more than 200 victims in Korea. In 1992, the Wednesday rally, Wednesday demonstration, started by the Korean Council for the Women drafted for military sexual slave by Japan, as you pointed out. And it is now marking its 30th anniversary, probably as the longest protest rally in the world on a single issue.
Yes, 200 over 200 women came forward to testify that they had been victims of this sexual enslavement, but estimates suggest that some 200,000 women, mostly Koreans, were forced into these Japanese military brothels during the Second World War. With that in mind, what would you say has been the significance of these Wednesday rallies? What role have they served over the years?
Well, since the rally started 30 years ago, the issue of comfort women has been handled by many many Korean and international organizations, including the United Nations. In the 1990s, there were at least two UN special rapporteurs who reported on this issue. And both of them concluded that the comfort women constituted a war crime and a crime against humanity. And they recommended an official apology and compensation by the Japanese government, as well as accountability, which means those responsible for the crime should be punished. In this process, the Wednesday rally process has been significant in a way, having represented the engagement by civil society, and also because the process has included the voices of the victims themselves. So the comfort women victims, usually old ladies, old women, and we sometimes call them halmoni in Korean, which means grandmother. Mm. So they have been always part of this rally for the last 30 years. And by now, of course, the number has, came down to merely a little over 10. Mm. But still, it has the importance in the sense that they always included these victims in the rallies.
Right, so these rallies have been a constant reminder of this issue. But as we said, the number of victims who still remain alive today are very few. With that in mind, what do you think the future holds for the rallies with the number of surviving victims diminishing?
Even if all the remaining victims pass away one day, that would not mean the comfort women issue will end, I think. Mm. It is because the issue is not only a bilateral issue between Korea and Japan, but also it is an international issue of human rights violation and of a war crime. Therefore, the Wednesday rally also needs to focus more on how the issue can be resolved in the international level. I think we can consider some international action down the road, such as a UN resolution similar to that applied for the Holocaust issue, which was, of course, about the mass killings of Jewish people by Nazi Germany. So in the United Nations, we have what is called a Holocaust resolution to remember what happened in history and to make sure that such a thing will not be repeated. So for when it comes to the comfort women issue as well, even if the issue is totally resolved between South Korea and Japan, we still have the issue at the international level, and that should be, to resolve this issue at the international level would be probably the last action that is needed to conclude this issue once and for all.
Sure, we can say the Wednesday rallies, they not only represent the victims that still are alive today, but they represent all the victims that have passed away, as well as all the victims known and unknown around the world that fell victim to Japan's atrocious atrocities. Now, You mentioned how there perhaps needs to be international action more as well. President Moon Jae-in's term ends in May. He expressed his gratitude today to the brave individuals who came out to support the rallies all these years. But what has been your overall assessment of the Moon administration's dealings with Japan on this issue during his presidency?
Well, the Moon government's handling of the issue of comfort women was not very different from the previous governments in South Korea. But as we all know, South Korea's relations with Japan, always have had ups and downs. And, there are many issues, both historical and current, that can undermine the ties between these two neighbors. But during the current South Korean government, I think we have to admit that the relationship has hit a new low. There are reasons for this downturn, both from Korea and Japan, and one should at least admit that both the super conservative policies of the previous Abe administration in Japan and also the unclear position of the Moon government in Korea on previous agreements with Japan, including agreement on comfort women issue and even earlier agreements on other issues, including forced labor. So, because the Moon government has not been too clear when it comes to its position on these previous agreements, so both of these factors in Japan and in South Korea have contributed to this current deadlock. But whatever the analysis is, we need to mend our fences, not least in the face of mounting global and regional challenges the two countries are faced with today.
Do you think this year's presidential election could serve as a chance for a reset of relations between Seoul and Tokyo? Is there anything that really can be done to change how Tokyo views their relationship with Seoul, especially over these historical disputes, whichever leader is in charge? Because it can at times seem frustrating and hope can seem difficult to see.
Yes, change of government in South Korea can provide that kind of opportunity, as you put it, an opportunity to reset the relations between South Korea and Japan. Traditionally, a change of power in South Korea has had more implications for its foreign policies compared to Japan, because in Japan, a leadership change does not necessarily result in change of policies, as we all know. But in South Korea, it has more such implications. Therefore, whoever wins the presidential election in March in Korea, I think that will probably provide an opportunity to reset, borrowing your expression, reset the relations between Seoul and Tokyo.
then would you have any advice that you would like to give to the next administration in terms of dealing with Japan and also with the victims in mind?
Well, our relation with Japan is not easy. You know, whatever government we have in South Korea, and it has a lot of historical problems and issues, and also it has a lot of implications for our future. So, but, you know, the bottom line should be that we need to improve our current ties with Japan for our future generation, you know, having an amicable and having a working relations, having cooperation with Japan is very important for our future, actually for the future of the two countries as a whole. So I think, we need to make more efforts to overcome the difficulties and overcome the differences and issues that we have with Japan, and try to work out a new relationship of cooperation for the future.
We'll have to wrap it up there. We've been speaking to Oh Jun, South Korea's former ambassador to the UN. Ambassador Oh, thank you once again for your time today.
Thank you very much.
Welcome to the Korea 24 Stock and Forex Update. The benchmark Korea Composite Stock Price Index fell 35.27 points, or 1.18% on Wednesday, closing the day at 2,953.97. The tech-heavy KOSDAQ also fell, losing 22.04 points, or 2.14%, to close at 1,009.62. On the foreign exchange, the local currency weakened 2.81 against the dollar, ending the day at 1,196.91. You can check Korean stock and forex closings at world.kbs.co.kr.
It's time now to look at some of the other news stories that have been trending online in Korea today. It is our daily segment, Korea Trending. And with those stories for us today is Walter Lee, who joins us now in the studio. Walter, hello.
Hello, Jung-ho. How are you today?
I'm good, thank you. So what do you have for us today?
Okay, so I've got an almost unbelievable story about a CEO of the country's largest dental implant manufacturer apologizing for one of its employees embezzling billions upon billions of won. And we'll also discuss a growing controversy over a particular shampoo that changes hair color. And finally, we'll find out how an Asian-American TV anchor turned the tables on a disgruntled viewer who left a racist voice message.
Okay, so we begin with an update on one of the most remarkable stories of the last week, as you mentioned, Walter, which we've not yet touched upon on the show. Mm-hmm. A massive embezzlement scandal that has shaken a major company here in Korea. Can you tell us more?
Yeah, so Ostem Implant, the nation's largest manufacturer of dental implants, has issued a statement regarding one of its employees embezzling, wait for it, 188 billion won in company funds. In a statement issued under the name of the company's CEO, Om Tae-kwon, on Wednesday, the firm apologized to major shareholders and customers for causing them concern with the latest incident. The statement is said the company is making all-out efforts to recover the embezzled funds.
Okay, let's just reiterate some of the incredible points there. A single employee who's said to be in the company's finance department mm-hmm. is said to have embezzled 188 billion won. That's 156 million US dollars. And it is now in the wind. There were reports that this was 92% of the company's net worth. And it's even led to the trading of the company's stock to be suspended since the beginning of the week. And of course, that has led to shareholders panicking about the money that they've invested in the company, particularly retail investors. So that's the situation. What else did the CEO say about this?
Well, Om claimed in Wednesday's statement that though large in size, the amount embezzled isn't big enough to harm the company's financial status. He said that it may seem like the company has lost almost all of its net worth, given that as of 2020, 188 billion won was equivalent to nearly 92% of the company's net worth. However, Om said such assessment doesn't hold true, as he cited that as of the end of 2021, the amount is estimated to be some 59% of the company's net worth. Om said the embezzled funds are expected to be recovered through police investigation, stressing that any setbacks in financial statements will be temporary, stressing that the company has in place an abundant cash flow. Om said there are no problems in maintaining business activities. Despite the latest incident, Osstem has set the goal of posting 1 trillion won, that's over 830 billion US dollars in sales this year.
So the business itself is said to be healthy, but still 59% of the company's net worth is still a huge amount, and people will be questioning how such a major corporation that reportedly has about 2,000 employees could have allowed something like this to happen.
Right.
How is the police investigation into the missing employee going? Have they found him yet?
Well, I'm afraid not. Police in Seoul's Gangseo district said they did determine that the employee surnamed E had remitted the embezzled funds to several bank accounts. Police are said to be taking steps to freeze accounts, which they determine have been used for E's crimes. Now, police grilled E's wife to determine where he is, but did not get many answers. They did manage to uncover that E had donated a 4-story building in Paju, Gyeonggi province, to his wife before he disappeared last Thursday. Osstem Implant filed a complaint with the police last Friday against E for embezzling the company funds.
Yeah, so an incredible, huge financial scandal, as we said. Okay, let's move on. What else do you have for us today?
Some more controversy is growing over a popular shampoo that adds colour to white hair. The local company of this shampoo and the Korea Advanced Institute of Science and Technology, or KAIST, which participated in the shampoo's development, are protesting the government's efforts to block the use of a particular chemical that's used in cosmetic products, trihoxybenzene, or THB, as I'll put it from now on, is a type of compound that allows dye to easily embed into hair strands without the need of peroxide. And while the shampoo in question doesn't contain dye, it does contain THB. Now, KAIST, in fact, developed a way for the shampoo to change hair color without the use of dye. The Ministry of Food and Drug and Safety issued last Monday on advance notice of revisions to cosmetic products safety standard that bans the use of THB in such goods. Now, the ministry will gather opinions on the revisions until January 17th before reaching a final decision.
Okay, so explain a bit more. Why is the ministry seeking to ban the use of THB in cosmetic goods?
Well, this is because it believes that the substance could cause skin irritation or possibly even worse. The ministry also cited that some European countries began prohibiting the release of cosmetic products with THB from last September on concerns that they could cause allergic reactions and diseases. However, KAIST underlined that Europe's ban measure applies only to dye products with a particular compound and does not apply to shampoo. It added that it's wrong to label the Korean-made shampoo as a dye product just because it contains THB. The shampoo company says the government is blocking efforts to export their hair products overseas, citing that it's seeking patent applications in 16 countries.
Right, so whilst there are legitimate concerns over THB, the makers of this product say the government is being too heavy-handed with its blanket ban and that their product and the way they use THB is safe. So what has the government said about such protests?
Well, the Ministry of Food and Drug Safety plans to gather opinion from the shampoo company and KAIST until January 17th before reaching a final decision on whether to prohibit the use of THB. If the ministry moves to prohibit it, the shampoo currently being sold in stores will all have to be pulled off shelves starting from mid-July.
And that will inevitably have a significant financial impact on the company, of course. So you can understand why they're protesting. We'll have to wait to see the government's final decision. Let's continue on now to our final story for today. What do you have for us?
Yeah, so our final story is about a TV anchor receiving a racist message after she mentioned dumpling soup on New Year's Day. Now, Michelle Lee of NBC affiliate KSDK in St. Louis mentioned dumpling soup during a segment on New Year's Day food. Lee is a Korean-American adoptee who was raised in St. Louis area. At the end of her piece, Lee ad-libbed that she ate dumpling soup on New Year's Day, adding, "That's what a lot of Korean people do."
Okay, so that sounds innocent enough. So how did this particular viewer respond, and what was this controversial message that he received?
Well, Lee revealed on her social media last Sunday a voicemail sent by a female viewer who said she took offense to Lee's remarks. The upset viewer provided the argument of how it'd be inappropriate if a white news anchor mentioned that they ate food on a New Year's that white people would eat. The anonymous caller then said that he was, quote, being very Asian and that she can keep her Korean to herself.
Wow, that is quite an extreme response to someone saying that they ate dumpling soup.
Right.
How did E respond to this message then?
Well, in a tweet titled, "I'd love to say something back," E wittingly wrote, "Can we all be #veryasian in 2022? Now, E's video drew an overwhelming response as it garnered thousands upon thousands of likes and retweets. The #veryasian was posted across social media with photos of dumplings. E's response also got many social media users, authors, influencers, journalists, actors, and politicians sharing online their experiences with racism on their holiday traditions, including one by Kansas City-based educator and KSHB senior investigative editor Ryan Takeo. He wrote on his Twitter that his New Year's resolution are, number one, be very Asian, and number two, eat more dumplings. Lee said she's excited to see where #veryasian goes, adding that she plans to call the woman back to invite her to get dumplings together.
Sure, it sounds like this woman has a very misguided idea, shall we say, if we're being generous, of
right.
what is deemed inappropriate. There is, of course, nothing wrong about celebrating diverse cultures, and that's all E was doing. I dare say, Walter, though, I'm feeling a little bit peckish myself for dumpling soup after all that talk
both.
Of it. Anyway, we have to wrap it up there for Career Trending. Walter, thank you for those stories, and stay very Asian.
Yes, I will.
Next up, it's our weekly literary corner, Korea Book Club, where we explore the world of Korean literature through works in translation. Joining me in the studio now to guide us through that world is our literary critic, Barry Welsh. Barry, Happy New Year. It's great to have you with us for another new year.
Yes, very Happy New Year to you too. Great to be back.
Yes, so what do you have in store for us today then, Barry?
Well, we're starting the year with a poetry collection called Feeling Never Stops. The Korean title is 느낌은 멈추지 않는다 by Anju Chol, and the collection was translated by Brother Anthony of Taizé, who is, of course, a prolific translator of Korean poetry. And it was published by Asia Publishers as part of their K-Poet series, and it was published with the support of the Literature Translation Institute of Korea in 2020. And it's the first time we've mentioned him, so I'll just give you a little bit of background about him. But An was born in Wonju in the Gangwon province, in Gangwon-do. He started his career back in 2002 with the publication of some poems in a journal called Changjakwa Bipyeong, which is basically the Creation and Criticism Journal. And since then, he's published a couple of collections in Korean. One of them is Things to be Done in the Next Life, and the other is I'm Only Alive When I'm Anxious. Feeling Never Stops is his first collection translated into English, and I believe it was the Korean edition was also published at the same time in a separate volume in 2020. Sorry.
Okay, so just from the sounds of the titles, they sound like works that cover some deep subject matters. What kind of poet is An? How is he viewed in the Korean poetry community?
Right, well, there's a lovely afterword from critic Kim Tae-soon in this volume, and Kim says of An, "When we read Andrew Chol's poems, we think of evening. At the time when the sun goes down, objects receive the glow of sunset and extend their shadows. It's time for them to let loose the darkness they had been harbouring, just as the sun sun, having risen, finally passes beyond the western hills. Everything that comes into the world will ultimately encounter its own evening. Living also involves disappearing. As they disappear, thus, things that exist also accumulate in themselves as much darkness as they have lived, secrets that cannot be revealed. And that's a lovely and great introduction to Anne's poetry. These are poems that are full of melancholy, full of darkness, and that often hint at uncomfortable secrets.
I see. So with that in mind, then, can you tell us about this collection today? What can readers expect?
So there are several poems in this collection that are inspired, or at least partly inspired, by walking, or that use walking as a metaphor for life. So we have Walking Beside the River, Parts 1 and 2, Walking Alone, Side by Side, and Walking in the Sunset Foam. And the first of those poems, Walking Beside the River, Parts 1 and 2, these are poems in which life is seen as a kind of endurance test. Life is a series of difficult and unpleasant challenges, and we just have to shoulder the burdens of our day-to-day existences and just keep marching on, just keep trudging forward on the path of life. And these burdens could be burdens such as having a demanding boss, or the struggle to maybe lose some weight. And as we shoulder these burdens, perhaps anger and resentment builds inside us. And Anne writes in the first of those poems, "I walk beside the river. I walk on, roughly honing from the outside the anger that begins to take shape following the riverside. Until I'm worn out and able to go to work tomorrow, until I can't deal with my boss at work because I'm so weak." And, you know, in these lines and in these poems, you know, I think we can see this sense that Anne sometimes think that life is a chore to be endured for as long as we have strength. And this seems to be a theme that recurs throughout the collection.
Okay, wow. So that is quite a depressing sentiment to start the new year, Barry. But is that the overall intention of the writer? Is life just a chore for Anne, or is there something, some light to balance out the darkness as well?
Yes, I'm sorry for the perhaps negative tone of this first choice for the year. But yes, everything is tinged with a sense of melancholy, if not outright despair. Even typical symbols of, you know, rebirth and happiness become kind of sad or melancholic wails of existential despair in Anne's hands in his poems. So, for example, there's a trio of poems inspired by spring, that usually happy time of year when flowers bloom, often celebrated by poets. But sadly for Anne, spring too is a profound source of crisis and bewilderment. So, for example, in Spring Night, he says, "There were times when I wanted to disappear from this world every day, yet I doubt if a truly human life has ever existed in this world." And again, we can see echoes of this sadness and feeling of loss.
Yeah, so a study in despair, it seems, then. So what can we learn from these poems? Are there any lessons or anything life-affirming to be found in Anne's work?
Right, so there certainly is. In this collection and in his essay, he writes a very moving essay at the end of the collection, but he does articulate a theory of life, or a view of life, a view of the life of, you know, of an average person, an average human. And we could roughly summarise this view as, you know, life is often difficult and painful and full of memories that will upset us, but it's this pain that lets us know we're alive. Life is pain, and we shouldn't want to escape our difficult memories because they're the stuff of lives. And we can see this most clearly in this essay. I mean, it runs through the poems, but then he kind of brings it together and expresses it quite clearly in the essay at the end of the collection. He says, "There's no way to escape from memory. People who can keep good memories for a long time are happy people. However, people who can keep bad memories for a long time are also happy people because they are alive." And throughout the collection, and, you know, poem after poem, we can see Anne write about this struggle that we all have with painful memories at this time of year, where many of us were reflecting on the previous year and our previous years and the path of our lives. And painful memories are something which most of us experience. We all have painful memories as part of the general weave of our lives. And Anne is saying that although painful, we should, in a way, treasure and value these memories too.
Right. So how would you recommend people approach this work? Because frankly, it doesn't sound like much fun, but maybe that's the point, I guess. Mm-hmm. Maybe
right.
We should perhaps start with the essay at the end and go from there, or would that perhaps... Mm-hmm. dull the impact of these poems?
No, the poems are... There's some individually, you know, very beautiful poems in the collection, but he does have, from this sort of personal essay at the end, he does seem to have this personal relationship with, you know, painful memories. I don't know if there was some specific traumatic event in his past that he keeps going back to, but there's definitely this sense of, you know, we carry these, the wounds that have been inflicted on us in the past, we carry those with us into the future. And, he has a relationship with his own painful memories. But he, you know, kind of circles around that issue in lots of different ways in the different poems and you know, comes at it in different ways. And he's even quite ironically humorous and playful about it. So I think he knows that... I think he knows that just being overwrought and deeply depressed all the time is kind of a chore. And he can be quite funny about that, the nature of the relationship with these painful memories too.
Sure. So it sounds like a collection. Perhaps that won't warm the cockles, but it still sounds like a fascinating look at life. Once again, it's called Feeling Never Stops by Andrew Toh. And that's all for Korea Book Club this week. Barry, it was great to see you again, and we'll catch up with you next time.
Okay, take care.
I am pianist William Yoon. You're now listening to Korea 24 on KBS World Radio.
We close out the show, as usual, with Morning Edition Preview, where we take a look at some interesting features or reports coming out in tomorrow's newspapers, namely the Korea Times and the Korea Herald, who we thank for providing us with their early editions to make this segment possible. And for that today, we have the return of our staff editor, Mark Wilson, chair, after his end-of-year break. Mark, hello, welcome back, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. Good to be back.
Yes, it's good to see you again. So, Mark, where are we headed to first today?
That would be to the People section in the Korea Times. Now, Jung-ho, if you look online, follow the news, maybe some related podcasts, you'll find one of many stories on the tattoo industry in South Korea. And I'll say, like, many of these sources, they all kind of start off the same. They talk about how tattoos were once stigmatized until recently as they were associated with organized crime. But I think I'd argue that the views of tattoos and those who make them, the artists, it started to shift actually in the 2010s, maybe the mid-2010s. Mm. And that's several years ago. So Kang Sung-woo's piece is interesting because it gives us a very up-to-date point of view from a young artist who only began in 2017.
Right.
Right. Kim Dong-hwa told The Times that when she started, her parents strongly disagreed and made her promise that she'd quit under the first signs of trouble. She said that she was relieved to find that tattoos had become more accepted as a form of self-expression as time passed.
We should note at this point that tattooing is technically still illegal here in South Korea. Only those with medical licenses are allowed to tattoo people, but... So what Kim is doing here actually is technically illegal, but authorities have tended to turn a blind eye, especially in recent years. And the fact that Kim has so openly come out and given this interview shows how much acceptance there is nowadays.
Good point.
And there is increased talk of changing the law soon to make tattooing legal for more people. With all that in mind then, so Kim, she's considers herself a developing artist. What has she seen then over the past 5 or so years when it comes to the tattoo industry?
Well, she told The Times that clientele is getting younger. She said it used to be in the mid-20s to 30s age group that were the main customers, but now mainly early 20-somethings are getting inked. Kim also made sure to note that artists agree not to ink minors. Mm. Kim also said that clients nowadays get tattoos to celebrate special events or to memorialize loved ones, not just to look cool, although that is a perk, I suppose. She in particular specializes in floral tattoos, which I'd argue in many cases goes hand in hand with memorialization and symbolism. And with a fine arts major in painting from Hongik University, she established herself as a renowned floral artist. So if you pick up tomorrow's Times, you can see her work for yourself, and it's definitely very painterly. And this is from a guy who studied paint himself.
Sure, of course. Yes, it definitely sounds like a fascinating insight into this industry, which, as you said, was once stigmatized, but has become more and more popular nowadays. Okay, let's move on. Where are we headed to next?
That would be to the culture section of tomorrow's Korea Herald. Park Ah-young writes that according to media reports on Wednesday, renowned South Korean conductor Jung Myung-hoon will be appointed as honorary music director of the KBS Philharmonic Orchestra. This news comes just days after Jung saved the orchestra's Christmas Eve concert by leading it on behalf of Pietari Inkinen, the orchestra's music director, who was unable to enter South Korea due to strict COVID-19 quarantine measures. And
right.
This is not the first time that Jung has done something like this. According to sources, Jung will officially be given the title sometime this month.
Right, so Jung, he's a household name, so it's not surprising that he might be considered for this role, but it is pretty significant considering that he had a bit of a rocky relationship with the KBS orchestra, right?
Yeah, it's been quite a roller coaster indeed. Park reminds us that Jung made his national conducting debut when he stood in front of the orchestra in 1972 at the age of 18. He also took the helm of the orchestra in 1998 as executive conductor and music director, but later stepped down amid a dispute with management. It wasn't until 2018 did he collaborate with the orchestra with pianist Garrett Olsen. Jung was named a strong candidate to become the KBS Orchestra's music director and executive conductor. But in April last year, I actually remember this, he said in an interview that he didn't want to become an executive music director at any orchestra because he didn't want the responsibility. But here we are, Jung-ho, with all the signs pointing to Jung becoming the orchestra's honorary music director. And though he's held the title for other orchestras in France and Japan, this will be the first time that he'll take the position in South Korea.
Yes, hopefully it will be smooth sailing, that he will have no troubles this time with the orchestra. It'll be interesting to see what kind of direction he takes the orchestra as well moving forward. We'll leave it there for Morning Edition Preview. Thank you for bringing us those stories, Mark, and we'll talk to you next time.
Talk to you then.
And that's where we wrap up this show today. Thank you for staying with us. We'll be back same time tomorrow, so do join us again then to continue to get your daily dose of Korean news analysis. I've been your host, Kwon Jang-ho, and thank you, as always, for listening. Goodbye.